Over the past couple years, we've been talking with three mayors around the country. In Dalton, Georgia, Gillette, Wyoming, and Corvallis, Oregon. Different places with different people, economies, and politics. Just before the election in November, we called up each of the mayors. In one conversation, I asked Dennis Mock in Dalton, Georgia, how he thought his community was going to vote. It's a small city, about 33,000 people. They make carpet there.
The manufacturing community here especially is hoping for the candidate with the least government regulation and the least government oversight and the least taxation of business. And they haven't really enjoyed the last 8 years of the Democratic regime in there.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. So now, a few months out from the election, how do people in those cities feel? We're visiting each of these places over the next few months and talking to the people who live there about their economies and their lives. First up, Dalton, Georgia. If you're standing on carpet right now, there's a good chance it was made in Dalton. When you pull into town, you see a big sign declaring it the carpet capital of the world. Steam from the plants streaks up into the sky. Huge warehouses run alongside roads and rail tracks. You know you're in a manufacturing city. But downtown has this intimate red brick feel. It's almost stereotypically cute. Right down to the Oakwood Cafe, where everyone is a regular. And yeah, we know, it's a cliche for the out-of-town reporters to stop in at the diner. But we went there to meet this guy.
The lady behind you was my kid's pre-K teacher. I go to church with the lady on the left. Lady comes in every day. Ace was one of my best friend's dads. And she works at the bank.
That's Casey Carpenter. He owns the place. He grew up here, runs a bunch of businesses, and he just gets Dalton.
You may not work for the carpet mills, but your business services the carpet mills, or your customers get their paycheck from the carpet mills. So it is a huge driver in the economy. Carpet mills are doing bad. Everybody's doing bad. I mean, just is what it is.
Dalton took a huge hit during the recession. When the housing market collapsed, carpet went right down with it. In March of 2009, the unemployment rate here was over 13%. Recovering from that meant changing both what the city makes, more diversified and recession-proof products, and how the carpet business is run. Smarter, leaner, with more technology and automation. And that includes basically growing the next generation of skilled workers.
I'm Brian Cooksey. I'm the director of operations training and development with Shaw.
That's Shaw as in Shaw Industries. It's one of the biggest flooring companies in the country, and it's owned by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. And when I say Shaw is aiming to bring in a young workforce, I mean young.
One of the things we started about 6 years ago was a middle school summer camp.
Yeah, summer camp. Cooksey says when they first started talking to 7th and 8th graders...
When you said, do you want to be an engineer? We realized that most of these students thought that was a train conductor. And so we had to talk about, you know, what does really an engineer do? And so we brought in some of our engineering talent to talk to them. They learned 3D design. They learned electronic circuit boards. They learned a little bit about programming so that they could get a feel for what these folks do every day.
His point, of course, is that these are not the manufacturing jobs of the 80s and 90s that many of these kids' parents had. The floor of the Shaw factory perfectly captures the transition between old and new. Massive multi-story machines run molten plastic through a series of sieves to create fibers.
So once we've broken down our spin packs, we'll burn them off. All of that hard polymer that was on there.
Those fibers will become yarn, which will eventually become carpet. It still looks and sounds like a typical factory, and there are still a lot of people on the floor keeping the machines running. But there are some clear signs of the future. Like Larry, Moe, and Curly, the huge laser-controlled robots that drive around the floor moving products. The future of manufacturing is more pronounced at the nearby engineered floors plant. It's a much smaller company than Shaw, one of the newest in Dalton, and more high-tech. We got a tour in a golf cart from executive James Leslie.
You know that scene in the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark where they're driving through the warehouse where all the things are stacked? I feel like that's what we're in, except it's all just yarn.
This is a very, very large facility. It's probably the largest one that we know of in the world for carpet.
Huge rolls of carpet are stacked all the way to the ceiling. Everything is astonishingly clean, bright, and orderly. There are computer stations sprinkled between the machines, and then a few people who keep things running.
I am Guadalupe Guido, and I am 23 years old.
She goes by Lupe and has worked here for almost 2 years. She's moved up 4 times, driving a forklift, working as a production clerk, and now she's a tufting scheduler, essentially programming the final steps in the carpet process. Guido makes $15.50 an hour. That's up from $11 when she started.
I've had a lot of opportunities here with the company, moving up pretty quick, and I don't feel like I'm going to stop no time soon.
Her entire family works in the carpet mills. Her parents came from Mexico to work here. Initially, they didn't want her to follow in their footsteps with a factory job. But like I said, these are not those jobs anymore.
Everything is computer-based now, so there is a lot of things that we have to learn. But it's always a good thing to learn about technology and knowing new stuff.
When she was younger, Guido thought about being a lawyer. But now she makes her own money, goes to one of the local colleges at night, and will get a bachelor's in human resource management this spring. She says she wants to run a plant like this one day. Lupe Guido is part of Dalton's big Latino population, 48% of the city. Those demographics make for some complicated politics in an area that voted largely for President Trump. Which brings me to the politician we came to visit in the first place, Mayor Dennis Mock, who gave us a driving tour of Dalton.
We'll start with our high school, City High School.
He's been in office for about 2 years. His background is in business, not politics, and he still works for the family produce company most mornings before heading to City Hall. He says he supported Trump because he was tired of establishment politics.
For me personally, and I think for a lot of other folks, he's actually made some strides and made some steps that we all felt like needed to be done.
He likes the idea of a fellow businessman in the White House and fewer regulations. But part of President Trump's rhetoric on immigration has caused trouble, especially for the undocumented residents here, who are afraid a trip to jail for a minor offense could mean they get deported. Dalton is 5 minutes from the Whitfield County Detention Center, which works closely with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Dennis Mock says it's his obligation to be the mayor for everybody living in Dalton. I asked him what kind of a city he wants for the future. He answered by driving us out to a reservoir that's being developed as a recreation area. It's nestled between 2 mountain ranges, surrounded by trees, and you can hear whippoorwills. It's gorgeous.
If we were to come out here like a year from now, what would you like to see?
I guarantee you we'll see people walking the loop around this lake. We'll see people out here fishing. We'll see classrooms out there on that point.
Yeah.
From the schools out here doing their nature studies. Hopefully we'll see a kayak or a canoe and maybe a rowing team from the college out here practicing.
It's part of his strategy to create a 21st century Dalton that will appeal to any company that might bring good jobs to town.
I consider this economic development. When we have companies that come here and want to know what their families can do and what their employees can do for entertainment, this will be one of them.
He invited us to come back when it's open, and for me, an avid angler, to fish. In a few years, he hopes this place will be full of people who work in the city, live and play in the nature around it, and have modern manufacturing jobs that give them a good life. We're going to have more from Dalton in just a minute. But first, we love doing the numbers here at Marketplace. It's our thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it away, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
4,444.
That's how many travelers' cell phones were inspected by U.S. Customs during 2015, the most recent year data was available.
It's a small fraction of the 383 million that come in every year, but recent high-profile inspections are raising questions for travelers.
Now, it's not mandatory to unlock a phone for a customs agent.
But if you have questions, the New York Times is a guide for what to do if you're asked to unlock your smartphone.
$500,000.
That's how much the National Zoo in D.C. pays to support wildlife conservation efforts in China.
The funds are part of a program that brings giant panda cubs to Washington. They're listed as vulnerable by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
This month, giant panda Bao Bao will fly back to Chengdu, China.
A couple years after she gets home, she'll enter China's panda breeding program. But for now, she's enjoying her long goodbye party at the zoo.
And we're enjoying the daily PandaCam broadcasts.
2,900.
That's the number of commercial planes served by Wi-Fi provider Gogo.
More and more passengers are using their own devices on flights, which means less time watching in-flight entertainment.
The airline research company Route Happy predicts that eventually the screens on the back of our seats might become obsolete.
So, are you telling me that I'm going to have to stream Bridget Jones' Baby on my phone now?
Yep.
Earlier in that story from Dalton, Georgia, you heard from Lupe Guido. After her workday at Engineered Floors, she does homework for her classes at Georgia Northwestern Technical College. It's one of two colleges in the city. The other is Dalton State, which offers bachelor's and associate's degrees. Dalton State attracts students from all over the area and the world. It sometimes feeds into the carpet industry. Many of the science majors get job offers from Shaw and other carpet companies. The college is also on the verge of becoming an HSI, Hispanic Serving Institution, which means almost 25% of its students are Latino. A lot of the school's kids are the first in their families to go to college. We met with a group of student leaders at Dalton State. They're friends who are also orientation leaders here.
My name is Diego Alvarado. I am 22 years old, and I am from Morelia, Michoacan, but my hometown, I would say, is Dalton, Georgia.
My name is Laura Licachel. I am 26. I am from Valencia, Spain, but I live in Calhoun, Georgia.
My name is Juan Garcia. I am from Valle Santiago, Guanajuato, but I'm here from Dalton.
My name is Marlon Hernandez Garcia. I'm 23 years old, and I am from San Pablo Pejo, Guanajuato, Mexico.
My name is Megan O'Toole. I'm 19 years old, and I'm from Chickamauga, Georgia.
We asked them about the future, both Dalton's and their own, and they let us listen to a conversation they said they couldn't have with just anyone at school. Megan, the only white student at the table, is part of a trusted group of friends who feel safe here, talking about the world and where they fit in it.
Both my parents work at Shaw right now. They've devoted 10 years to working at Shaw, and it's hard work, but they don't shy away from hard work. They've always told us it's okay if you work at a factory. You know, it pays well, gives you benefits, but they've really fostered working with your mind than working with your hands because they know how hard it is. I mean, we've probably all had those days when your parents come back tired and complaining, but they still go back to it every single day.
Being, I guess you could say, Hispanic or Latino, you live with this racial tension your whole life that a lot of people don't really understand. And it really, really affects you in the way you grow up and the way you study, what careers you choose. When Trump got elected and we found out that he won, I got a lot of racial tension towards me just because of my skin color. Even though I consider myself an American, it's been hard, but I guess what can we do about it?
I think it has brought out the true colors of everyone because, like Juan was saying, do we feel attacked? Yes, every day. But I think this is where the atmosphere comes in, where your open-mindedness comes into place as well. You might get racial comments from students, but then you have to understand that they don't know what it is to have, like, to be stepping in your shoes.
We came here illegally, me and my family. So both my parents, me and my twin brother were illegal. So we went through the same troubles that a lot of undocumented people go through, trying to get a job without a Social Security card, trying to go to school, trying to get all these programs that benefit permanent residents and citizens. And so we paid hefty fines to become permanent residents. One of the things that a lot of people don't understand about becoming documented is it takes money. It takes a lot of money to become documented. And from the village that I live in, you know, if you work in a car factory for 8 hours, you get $6 American, and it takes about $1,000 to try and document yourself. And you can never get to the point where you can safely go into America and try to find these opportunities. And when people talk about illegal immigration or they talk about legal immigration. I think that's lost the economics of it. So when we got the opportunity to become American citizens, we took it. My mom took the test first. We were all very encouraging of her. But sometimes it's a little on the hard side if you don't know or understand English very well, because there's an English component to it. So she memorized all the questions. Of 100 questions that they could possibly ask you, she memorized all of them and the answers. She has given 20 years of her life to America, to its economy, and 10 years to the Dalton community. So she wanted to become a citizen so she could give more, have the chance to vote in our election. So she memorized all of them and she passed. we were so proud of her. And so my brother immediately went next. He passed. And so I was like, if they can do it, I can do it. So I took the test, passed it, and my family and my orientation family was there. And I got sworn in. Laura Lee came by. It's really encouraging to know that there are so many people out there that want you to succeed.
And I can't wait till I become a citizen. Right? Become a citizen in about 3 years.
Yes, just the way. And it's so be good.
Because, I mean, like Marlon said, you are part of this country. Yeah. This country is home. And it sucks that the government says it's not your home.
And that is something that even if you're Hispanic, but you're born here, you do not know what it feels like just to sit in an immigration office, nerve-wracking, like, whatever I say, if I breathe in the wrong time, like, yes. you get that little red mark that says entry denied, and your life is over.
You asked that if we, you know, after we graduate, if we want to, you know, stay here and live here. I actually want to move as far away as I can from here. I plan to actually move to California. Shaw is like offering me a sales job on their marketing team. So I was just like, what do I do? Do I stay here or do I go to California and feel comfortable?
I want to come back. I would love to come back and actually work at this college to recruit the Hispanic ones, because we're about to be an HSI or 24.8 and we just need 0.20. So
exactly.
Go Roadrunners.
I probably speak for a lot of you, but family is everything. And I would follow my family anywhere across this world to be with them and support them through everything. And I think of Dalton State as my family. They have definitely made an impact on me. And I hope I have made an impact on Dalton State.
I feel the same way. I feel such an emotional connection to Dalton and Dalton State. And I know that I'm probably going to have to leave Dalton eventually to fully get what I want. But my dream is to be able to come back to Dalton and be able to give back to this place that's given me so much. I've been able to succeed in so many things. I've had so many connections. I mean, I'm still technically a freshman, and already I feel like this is home.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. By now, of course, you've probably heard some of President Trump's news conference from Thursday. One of the things he discussed was this.
I just wanted to begin by mentioning that the nominee for Secretary of the Department of Labor will be Mr. Alex Acosta.
And we're going to talk about that announcement in this week's installment of Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week are Marketplace's Andy Euler and Andrea Chang from the LA Times. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks.
Andy, I'm going to start with you because this is a story that's been in the news constantly and is both about what's happening in this upcoming week and kind of a larger strategic political thing. Talk about what you are long.
Yeah, I'm actually long on sort of the idea that the Trump administration is trying to make it easier for itself to get its appointees passed through Congress. Andrew Poster taking his nomination back and deciding not to do it because of all the things that came out. And then subsequently this week, the Trump administration said, okay, Alexander Acosta, who, you know, is the dean of a law school in Florida. He's the first Latino appointee to this cabinet. It seems like at least this is one of those, okay, we get it. This is going to be our response to sort of what's happening and all of the eyebrows that are being raised with all of these appointees. I think that's happening. I could be completely wrong, but I think it actually is.
But you're long on the idea that this is a White House response to some of the criticism that has been lobbied, and we should say from its own party.
Sure.
But also a lot of the stories have been out about sort of chaos and not kind of taking cues from outside appearances.
That's exactly right. I think I'm long on the idea of this administration sort of, like you said, taking cues or at least listening to some of that criticism, wherever it comes from, sort of listening to what's happening and the other opinions that are out there instead of just saying, all right, this is our guy, this is our lady, this is who we're going to appoint. We don't really care what you think. I think this is sort of a signal that maybe they are listening.
I hope that's the case. I do hope that's the case. It's just I feel, I guess, less optimistic about what's happening with the administration. I wonder what would have happened if Pester just hadn't dropped out. I think they would have continued backing him until the end.
And we should say we're not privy to the internal conversations that people in the administration are having with their nominees. Nobody is. If Andy, if this long, I want to play with this idea a little bit about sort of taking cues from, say, members of Congress or even from the media. Does that actually alienate some of the people who've supported the president because he didn't do the traditional cue-taking from the Washington establishment?
Right, or saying things like, I can't believe I'm saying this right now, I'm a politician now. You know, things like that. I think you're right.
Well, guess what? When you're the president of the United States, you are a politician.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like to me that that sort of alienates that voter because – I also think that they're going to be very, very selective. It's not like they're just throwing a, you know, they're not throwing a Democrat out there to be the, you know, Secretary of Labor. It's somebody who still sort of makes sense for this administration. I just think maybe they're listening a little more. Maybe.
What do we know about Acosta?
We know that he's actually sort of been on the board of labor groups and things like that. So it seems like his credentials sort of line up for the job maybe a little more than, you know, somebody who was a businessman.
Right. And had been in a lot of high profile fights and lawsuits,
right.
You know, about some of the businesses that CKE, which is the holding company, ran.
Right. Right. Exactly. The wage violations, things like that. I mean, that's not sort of what you want your labor secretary to be called out for if you're in a confirmation hearing. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's anything to make this process a little bit easier for the administration. I think they're taking cues.
Yeah. Especially after, you know, with like with DeVos, it was such a close call. I think just picking someone that might be able to kind of ease in there is probably what they're looking for now.
All right, so I'm going to make a transition from, oh my gosh, I'm going to say this on the air, real news to fake news.
All right.
Andrea, with your long. Tell me about your long.
Well, mine is also kind of Trump-related as well. I'm going long this week on SNL.
Saturday Night Live.
On Saturday Night Live, that's right. In light of the massive ratings that they have been pulling in all season long. So Trump is making SNL's ratings great again. It's the most watched season in 22 years, and that's thanks in large part to Alec Baldwin, who's been portraying Trump for several weeks. And then more recently, Melissa McCarthy, who's had a very funny take on Sean Spicer, the press secretary. This most recent Saturday saw 10.8 million viewers, which was SNL's largest audience since January of 2011.
Wow.
You know, this is a show that's always done really well when it comes to politics.
Right. I mean, Gerald Ford falling down the stairs was like one of their original gags.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
I should say Chevy Chase is Gerald Ford falling down the stairs.
Right.
And then later, Gerald Ford eaten by wolves, which is, of course, the Tom Brokaw thing.
Yeah.
I do really
Ford
bad Tom Brokaw.
You're also, I mean, everyone's like having conversations about it, too. You're seeing it on like the cable news networks that are like dissecting every portrayal, you know, come Monday.
And we know
morning.
The president himself is paying attention to this.
Exactly.
Right. And it feels like, too, people are watching press conferences and things like that more. So there's a little bit more of a reference, you know, because Donald Trump talking to the press is almost really, really watchable.
It is really watchable. I mean, I think that there is an interesting thing about shared cultural language, even in a time of tremendous political divide. You're right. Something like SNL is like, oh, people are watching this. Press conferences, people are watching this. No matter how you process it, we're all experiencing this stuff, and we're all experiencing it incredibly quickly and almost kind of in surround, mental surround sound, given the saturation of broadcast, cable, social media, lovely, lovely public radio, all of those things. Okay, I want to pivot to your short, Andrea, because let's get away from politics for a while. Mm-hmm. Take me to good old-fashioned family entertainment.
All right. Well, unfortunately, I have to go short this week on Disneyland affordability. Prices are going up or have gone up $2 to $5 for daily passes and as much as $20 for multi-day tickets and annual passes.
Whoa.
I know. So what that means is if you want to go on like a peak day in the summer, it's going to cost you $124.
Wow.
This is kind of crazy given that just 2 years ago, the talk was whether or not Disneyland was going to go beyond $100 because that's when they did $99. Mm-hmm. And that was already like, oh my God, I can't spend $100 to go to Disneyland. So anyway, we're like beyond that. If you want to go July 4th weekend, you're looking at $124. And then if you add in like your Mickey Mouse ears and your corn dog and your Dole Whip.
I mean, and having more than one child. Right.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of who now goes? Is it the same kids, same families that go to Disneyland? I mean, is it have they priced themselves
and
out?
And if you're an East Coaster, hey. Hi, I am. Disney World.
Oh, Disney World, yeah.
Yeah, come on.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I went to Disney World as a kid. But
I did too, yeah. But I mean, growing up in California, I maybe my parents felt this way, but I felt like it was still something that you could go to as a family of four.
Sure.
And now everyone who talks about Disneyland, I mean, it's tough on your wallet. And I do wonder what happens if you're just a family, you're a middle-income family that wants to take your kids. It's not that easy.
Which is just sort of astonishing when you think of that as, you know, as we have all of these conversations about the American middle class, the Disneyland or Disney World experience feels like a profoundly middle class American experience.
Yeah.
And maybe that just shows like how tightly knit we are into capitalism as a society. But also, I remember going, you know, my dad took me. It was mm-hmm. a special thing we did together. It was a huge, huge deal in my life.
My dad took us because the newspaper that he was working for had just gotten purchased by Disney.
Oh.
And so we got free tickets.
Oh, so you.
So my parents could rationalize it.
Yeah,
that
was awesome. Yeah. All right, let's stick with the corporate world for a little bit,
okay.
And I guess entertainment of a sort. Andy, hit us with your short.
I'm short on just egregious branding. This week, the NBA, the National Basketball Association, announced that its developmental league, which is kind of a league, kind of the minor leagues of basketball. And so they announced this week that it would no longer be called the D League. It's now going to be the G League. Because it's the NBA Gatorade League. So what the NBA is saying, how they're sort of rationalizing it, is, look, Gatorade has a ton of scientists and they have a ton of great information that we can sort of help advance these players more quickly. It doesn't feel like that to me. It seems like what they're doing is having to make more jerseys. They're having to literally rebrand the balls that they use with G League on it. So Gatorade is making a pretty, pretty heavy presence in this developmental league. I mean, they're literally the name of the league.
Yeah.
This is a conversation Andy, you and I had before walking in the studio. I genuinely don't know what to call some of the stadiums that I went to when I was younger anymore because they've changed corporate sponsorship so many times.
Exactly right. I grew up in the Bay Area, and every time I'm up there, I'm like, wait, what are they calling the place where the Warriors play? Because it has gone through a lot of name changes, and that's why I'm so happy Staples Center continues to be Staples Center.
For now,
because that one I can remember.
Sure.
But I agree with you. I mean, I think it's a bit much, and it's not like people don't already know that Gatorade has a huge presence in all sports leagues. So calling it the G League, I mean, that I don't like it.
Well, and Michael Jordan being sort of the poster child for Gatorade, dude played basketball. We don't need to associate Gatorade with basketball.
What does the NBA get out of this? Since obviously Gatorade gets our name everywhere.
Right. So this is what the NBA is trying to tell us. They're trying to sell us the idea that they're actually going to be making these players better with better science through the Gatorade Institute. And so they're saying, look, we have all of these, you know, all of this data that's going to be processed through Gatorade that just doesn't feel rational to me.
You know, people are not at quite the level that they are when you see your professional game. Like, it's really fun to watch people kind of scrap it out.
Yeah.
I have more bad news for y'all, too. They're already talking about branding jerseys in the NBA very soon, kind of like soccer jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
So we might have more branding from the NBA coming up.
Andrea Chang from the LA Times, Andy Euler from Marketplace. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
No, thank you, Lizzie.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead.
This week, the new Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, went to his first NATO ministerial meeting in Brussels. He repeated what the president has said about NATO, that Europeans need to spend more on their own defense, and if they don't, that the U.S. could, quote, moderate its commitment to the alliance. But America's allies want reassurance from the new administration on Russia, which has been building up its military forces in the Arctic. The region is estimated to have more oil and gas reserves than Saudi Arabia. The BBC's defense correspondent, Jonathan Beale, went to the Arctic Circle, and he has this story.
Winter in the Arctic Circle, and the days are now getting longer. But the weather's still unforgiving. We joined the Norwegian border guard on skidoos, the fastest way to travel around this icy wilderness. They switch to skis when they reach a fence, primarily to stop reindeer wandering across into Russia. But more importantly, it marks the point where east meets west. This is the NATO alliance's most northerly border. At times, a pretty inhospitable place. It's blowing a blizzard, and the ice is biting into my face. But every day, all year round, the Norwegian army mount patrols on the border with Russia.
We always carry a rifle. That is how our posture is.
Lieutenant Colonel Jorn Quiller is the commander of the Norwegian border guard.
I don't think we can say that there are a lot of increased activity. They have had high activity here in the north all along. So they are training well and preparing themselves as we are doing on our side.
And as you know, General, just in the past few years, the buildup in the Arctic by the Russians has been quite dramatic. A new Arctic command, four new Arctic brigades, 14 operational airfield, 16...
Fears about Russia's military buildup in the high north were expressed by Dan Sullivan, one of the Republican senators from Alaska, at the confirmation for the new defense secretary, General James Mattis.
What do you think Russia's trying to achieve in the Arctic with that massive military buildup?
I don't know. I believe, however, that we are going to have to figure it out and make certain that we're not seeing an expansion.
Okay, back this way. Put your poles on the side first.
U.S. Marines, who would have once been commanded by General Mattis, are now back in the Arctic. Here, jumping into an ice hole in full military kit.
511-175524, request permission to leave the ice.
Just one of the tests as they learn to survive and fight in cold climates.
Well, what I'm going to go through now is another method of moving called double poling.
They're working with the British Royal Marines who've been training here for years. But after a long absence, the US Marines have returned to Norway on what will be a continuous rotation. Their Major General Neil Nelson is reluctant to say this is all about Russia.
It's always important to have a military presence and a cooperative agreement with our NATO allies. And so that's what we do.
And then when Russia says this is unhelpful, this is causing tension, what do you say?
I say that we continue to support the NATO strategic plans, and we allow the politicians to work through what they have to work through.
But for the people of Norway, like the rest of Europe, they're getting mixed messages from the new US administration.
Well, it's too cold to play soccer outside, but indoors there is this kids' tournament going on just a few kilometres away from where the US Marines are stationed. And we've come to ask their parents whether they feel tensions with Russia are rising.
I'm more afraid of Donald Trump than Putin.
When you look at Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, which of those two would worry you more?
Both. How could you possibly pick just one?
I'm actually more worried about Trump than Putin. Because Putin is like a controlled maniac, but Trump is uncontrollable maniac.
Back out on patrol with the Norwegian border guard, it is business as usual. But no one can deny these are uncertain times. With an increasingly assertive Russia and a new US president who's keeping everyone guessing.
That's Jonathan Beale from our partners at the BBC. From physical security, we're going to turn now to cybersecurity. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, was at the RSA Security Conference this week. That's where a lot of tech firms get together and talk about security and how we protect ourselves. That means everything from government email to how many times you should change your password. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Lizzie.
So you've been at the RSA Security Conference all week. What are you hearing from people there?
This is a really interesting event because it's so enterprise-focused. It's really about businesses trying to figure out how to protect themselves. But most of the time, there is some common theme that people can get behind in terms of what is the big threat, what is the big conversation. This year, the conversation is all over the place because it's kind of the year in which the worst fears of a lot of security researchers came true. Nation states enacted hacking on a massive scale.
Yeah.
Internet of Things connected devices were actually turned into sort of a collective botnet that was used to take down a huge chunk of the internet. There have been so many kinds of attacks that people almost don't even know what to focus on.
You and I have had these conversations about cybersecurity before, and they shift and change, as you're noting, you know, as people kind of get focused on different things and we see different breaches. What should we be focusing on protecting ourselves from now?
Well, you know, the first thing that we have to do in a lot of ways, and everybody keeps saying this, is we have to protect ourselves from ourselves. We are our own worst enemies when it comes to security. And you've seen companies take steps to try to protect us, like make sort of invisible encryption in tools like iMessage and WhatsApp. But the fact is, we still make dumb mistakes left and right. We need to be focused on our behaviors. And it's stuff that we've been saying for years in the tech world, like don't reuse your passwords. That's still totally true. But, you know, look, if you look back at some of the major things that happened over the past year, some of the hacks that were released, even in the election cycle, John Podesta's emails, that stuff happened because of not great security hygiene. Whether it was forwarding material to an unsecure email account, like a personal account that you would reuse the same password on a newspaper comment system, right? That stuff is sort of basic behavior that we all do that we have to take a second look at, I think, because every one of us as an individual, a hacker looks at us as the way in, the way into a bigger system.
A lot of people seem to either have faith that like, I'm not that important. It doesn't really matter to me. And or, well, so much is happening that I'll get lost in the crowd.
Right. And I think that that was a reasonable assumption for a long time. Security through obscurity. The idea that if you're not a high value target, people aren't going to be coming after you in such a specific way. But the fact is that malicious hackers will just blanket the world, blanket countries with attacks. So any one of us, I think it's sort of a mindset that any one of us is now a target anytime.
That brings up this question of where is the onus? Is it on manufacturers? Is it on regulators? And who can you trust when, as a consumer, you're trying to figure this stuff out?
Yeah. And I would say all of that. And that's what's so interesting about RSA this year is that these manufacturers, these companies are having that conversation. It's like a huge problem to solve, and solutions have to come from everywhere because the fact is that we're losing. Now, what you're seeing is companies try to come up with all sorts of solutions, and some of them are almost as questionable in the intrusion as the intrusions themselves. You could argue, for example, I spoke to Matt Moynihan, CEO of a company called Forcepoint. It's a cybersecurity firm. What they want to do is pioneer a model of security that's based on human behavior. So you know how if you all of a sudden start shopping in Istanbul when you usually shop in New York, you might get a call from your credit card company?
Yeah.
What Forcepoint wants to do is learn the behaviors of employees inside companies so that it can detect when they're doing something that's out of the ordinary. Now, on the face of it, that sounds fairly benign and actually kind of obvious. I was surprised that not everybody's doing that. But it also means asking employees to give up a lot more personal information, to let the company learn about you the way that, as he put it, Google, Facebook, and Amazon learn about us, and we let them. And here's what he had to say about it.
I think it should be an argument. I think it should be a debate, right? I do think that you're seeing a trend where people are starting to participate in ways that they hadn't before, right, to make sure they're heard. It's a fundamentally different world than it was, right? And I think not for a minute should we not stop fighting for the right to privacy and a lot of the things that are foundational in this country. But just like people are clicking opt-in to get free email, we really need to think long and hard around, is privacy a currency that can be used for good as opposed to just free email?
Molly, this raises a huge question for me, which is this idea of, is privacy free or is it a good? Should we be willing to think of this as a market for, you know, our own security?
Yeah. Is privacy a currency is a really provocative statement. Those are the kinds of questions people are asking. One of the things that I talked to Matt Moynihan about was the situation with Apple and the encrypted iPhone after the San Bernardino shootings and how, you know, half the country thought Apple should unlock the phone, build in a backdoor to the encryption and hand over the information. And the other half thought, no, right? This company has promised to protect our privacy and they have to do that. So there's no question that there is a debate and that in fact, some of the information that we take for granted about ourselves might be harnessed and used more broadly to prevent the kinds of intrusions that we basically saw happening during all of 2016 and have seen increasing over the last few years.
Marketplace's senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
Words of Monty Python. And now for something completely different. It's time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight questions about work and money to hear their stories and learn from their experiences. This week, an electronic pop duo takes our quiz.
This is Matthew.
And I'm Asa from Electric Guest.
And you're listening to Marketplace.
Asa, in a next life, what would your career be?
I think about this a lot because I'm like, will this music thing work out? And unfortunately, I don't have an answer. So I'll probably be broker than I am now. You know, actually, I revised. I think I'd probably do something in the music industry. Like maybe I'd work for a label or something.
Yeah. I'd probably actually become a music editor because I'm pretty good at Pro Tools, so.
Matthew, what's the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
Not knowing that anything will ever happen and the self-doubt that comes with it, I think, is probably the hardest thing.
Yeah, talk about last night.
Yeah, last night I got food poisoning. After we played Seth Meyers, I was literally throwing up in my hotel room until 2:30 in the morning or something like that, and I'm here right now talking to you.
Literally like 20 minutes
after we played. And it's not easy to do that, but it's stuff you have to do when you're on the road and you aren't home and it's kind of uncomfortable and you just maybe want to stay in bed, but you can't.
He killed it, though. He killed it during the performance.
Asa, when did you realize that music could become an actual career?
Probably like 7 years ago, I realized that I might be able to do this for my living when I was doing stuff for Saturday Night Live with my brother. Just like little checks. It wasn't like crazy money, but I was like, oh, I can pay my rent and I don't have to have another job. And the first time I got paid for actually playing music was probably when we did some TV stuff. Like we did David Letterman and we got like paid off that because everything before that we had kind of lost money on the live side. Matthew, what was your very first job?
I worked at a movie theater as a projectionist in Danville, Virginia, where I grew up. And it was great because everyone that worked there actually played music. So at night, we would just stay after and play music right in the front where the screen was until like 5 in the morning. Also, there was a curfew, so I had to stay until about 5 in the morning, from midnight till about 5 in the morning because we're supposed to be out, so yeah, it was great. It was amazing. Loved it. Asa, what advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
You know, I got a lot of advice from my mentor, this dude, Danger Mouse, who produced our first record with me. And he's, I have to admit, he covered a lot of ground, like everything from finances to kind of the emotional side of touring and approaching music. So I don't know, and I was just thinking about like what didn't we go over? It's not that I knew everything by any means, but I definitely got a lot of advice. I remember the first 2 weeks of our tour, he pulled me aside and he was like, "You should know every band breaks up." And it's kind of like a crazy thing to say right off the bat, but it's good because it's, and he's like, if you want to avoid it, like read up on bands that actually survive. And so I think, you know, me and Matthew have just tried to kind of approach this with gentleness for each other so that we can have it be a long-term thing. But I was lucky. I think I got a lot of advice.
Yeah, and I think for me it was just about, I think doing this band, we're very self-sufficient, and in earlier bands when I was growing up, I wasn't, and relied too much on a record label or an engineer, and I think really everyone has the resources at their fingertips to do whatever they want, and the more you do stuff on your own and the more you're kind of responsible for your own stuff, I think it's the best. You have more control over it, and it's just more beneficial overall, I think.
Electric Guest's album Plural is out now. And that's our show for this week. Next week, I'll be on a reporting trip to Gillette, Wyoming, and we'll bring you those stories in a few weeks. Remember, you can always come talk to me or the team at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman, with help from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe and Brian Allison are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.